Hello, and welcome back to the Center for Children, Families, and Workforce Development podcast. I'm Zach Reamer. Today's topic is a big one, psychotropic medications and how they relate to our work with children. Now, pharmacological interactions in a complex system that is the human brain is no easy subject to learn. So, our guest is someone who can break it down into a digestible and easy-to-understand description. That guest is Kenneth Chatrand, the University of Montana Director of Pharmacy at the Curry Health Clinic. Ken answered a few of my questions in the pharmacy counseling room, where students typically talk to their pharmacists about the substances that they've been prescribed. So you might hear some of the comings and goings of the pharmacy in the background. Without further ado, let's just jump straight into our conversation.
Would you mind saying who you are, what you do, and maybe a little bit of your background?
Yeah, absolutely. My name is Ken Chatrand, and I'm the pharmacy manager here at the Health Service Pharmacy at the University of Montana. I've had this position now 10 years, and I was able to kind of specialize and get this job and help college students. And why I love that is the college student population is so eager to learn and really get a lot of information from a pharmacist and for their healthcare. It's the first time that they've been out on their own. Typically, mom and dad's out there have always footed the bill for any medications that they might need, but handled the whole insurance issues, what drugs to use, all that type of stuff. So it's been really, really nice because I really like to take a handle in making sure that not only do the students get the medications they need, but they know how to use healthcare appropriately. And I think that that is one of the best things that they can learn when they get out there in the real world.
That's great work. I'm thinking back to like my own parents, and you know, they even know the questions to ask. I didn't know the questions to ask.
Right, exactly. We get the wide-eyed little bambies out there that have no idea. They just know that they need a birth control, they need their depression medication, mm-hmm. or they're sick and they need an antibiotic, and kind of how to lead them into getting those decisions is really kind of cool.
Cool.
So it's been an excellent opportunity for me to become a better pharmacist.
So our population that we're kind of concerned with at the center is probably a little younger normally than the average college-aged student, but also in that realm. So adolescents and children. And this, I'm hoping our conversation will kind of illuminate a little bit of the mystery around psychotropic medications and children using them, and hopefully answer some of those questions that I didn't know to ask when my parents were doing all of the asking. So could we maybe just start really basic and say, what are psychotropic medications?
So psychotropic medications are anything, any substance that a person uses that will alter the brain chemistry and have it respond in a different way. So with psychotropic, when we say psychotropic, it is a big class of medications. And it could even be pain relievers that would help you with pain. These cause drowsiness and dizziness. That would be considered as psychotropic medications. And then there's the stimulants used for ADHD in pediatrics, adolescents, and adults. Those also alter that brain chemistry a little bit. So again, you get a stimulant version of that one. So it's a big, big class, and trying to get down to the very basics is sometimes difficult because it depends on what you're treating and what you're using it for. It could be for a doctor diagnosis that you have ADHD or depression or another mental health issue that we're treating, or it could be more of the illicit substances, the heroin, the cocaine, marijuana, things like that, that also alter substances in the brain, the mood. So it's a really, really wide class. But ultimately, when you get down to it, psychotropic medication is used to alter the brain chemistry. And what I usually consider what we're trying to do is more of a balancing act, where we're trying to balance out how the brain is communicating to its counterpoints and the rest of the body.
That makes sense. And so it is broad, but generally you can say that a psychotropic medication alters the brain.
Absolutely.
So, and you touched on this, but the types of conditions that might be treated with psychotropic medications, anxiety, ADHD.
Anxiety, ADHD, your mental health disorders. So you're going to be talking about, again, the depressions, schizophrenia, bipolar. It can even be a substance for night terrors, postpartum depression in pregnant women or ones that have just given birth. And it can be for PTSD. So it's a wide variety of uses on those medications.
Sure, and you could even use a psychotropic medication to work with addiction, to counteract another type of psychotropic
100%.
Agent. 100%,
and addiction, what we do consider that a mental mm-hmm. health issue. So absolutely, that'd be grouped into that process.
Okay, so going from what, the question of what, maybe we'll shift to why. And why would a child or adolescent need to take a psychotropic medication? I mean, one reason is that they have a mental health disorder or condition that maybe requires it, but could you expound on that a little bit?
Absolutely. So what I recommend to a lot of my students, honestly, is to take some time out of their day and to watch Disney's Inside Out. If you haven't ever seen that movie, it is a great movie just to watch in general. But when you're thinking about brain chemistry and kind of what's going on, if you specifically watch that movie with that in regards, you will be amazed at how much information you learn, and you can see how complex things can get when just one thing goes wrong. And I think when a person has attention deficit disorder, let's just focus on that one for a second. We typically stereotype those children and adolescents and adults for that matter into a grouping where they're not focused, they don't care, they're just overreactive and hyperactive. So you think of the little boys and girls in the class that are constantly disrupting the class, that are constantly messing up, being the class clown, and more of that attention-seeking behavior. When in fact that is completely and utterly wrong. What happens and why we give a stimulant, which doesn't necessarily make sense, at least when I went through pharmacy school, I said, why are we giving a stimulant to a kid that's hyperactive? And it's because how the brain communicates, and going back to that Inside Out, imagine that you have all these characters in your brain and one of them is missing. Or what if one of them is speaking French and the other is speaking English? They don't understand each other. So you're going to need something to help them understand and communicate to them, whether it be a almanac that says, here's how to transpose what's going on here and what they're talking about, or trying to balance it out a little bit. So why we give a stimulant to those people that need that medication and for ADHD is because they actually don't have enough to keep focused. So instead of being able to focus on the one thing they need to focus on, they're trying to focus on the 100 other things going on, which makes it look like they're not paying attention and then they're acting out. But giving them that stimulant, it's a balance act. Mm-hmm. And with that balance, they can finally focus and calm their system down, because it's really been an overdrive trying to correct everything. Mm-hmm. So being able to use those medications to balance that brain chemistry and kind of normalize it really helps those people function on a daily basis.
And these medications might be used with other therapies, right?
Absolutely, 100%. The pharmacotherapy and the treatment of drugs is just a piece of the pie. And what we need to look at is not stereotyping a person with a drug or a disease state for that matter. I don't have my patients come up and say, oh, there is my schizophrenic patient, or there is my patient that can't focus. I say, there's John, or there's Susie. They are a person, and they need to be treated as a person first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be maybe through the use of pharmacotherapy and medications, but it's also going to be through counseling, which is a major component of everything that has to do with the psychotropic medications. If they're not coupled with counseling, then that drug effect isn't necessarily going to be working that well. And it's almost like putting a Band-Aid on a leaking wound. If you're not correcting the wound first, it's going to keep on leaking, and a Band-Aid will only go so far.
And so you're a pharmacist, so this is your area of expertise, but what are the alternatives and what people call naturopathic remedies for psychotropic medications?
Absolutely. A lot of our medications are actually derived from natural sources, and we have proven that there are some medications out there that have been effective and safe in treating some minor disorders. However, the studies that are done with that particular class aren't very robust. It's more anecdotal evidence that said, hey, this worked for one person. A prime example of this one is St. John's wort for depression. If you do a search online and get some information, it looks like it works really, really well. And then for very minor cases and mild depression, it may be beneficial. However, when you're talking a little bit more complexity, then that really starts falling apart. Not only that, but being on those medications, they're not studied as well as other medications that we have, and the drug interactions that are involved in that one can be severe. St. John's wort by itself will alter the way that other medications work. And so if you get placed on a medication, it could either be subtherapeutic, which means that we're giving this to you, but it's not working. It's not reading where we that concentration in your body where we want it to go. Or worst case scenario, it will get toxic and it'll work almost too well and it'll kill some of your organs off. It's again a balancing act. So on those natural remedies, I, as a pharmacist, typically say, let's start with what we know first and how we studied it. And then those are more last-line therapies, not first-line therapies that I typically recommend, at least for the medications. Yeah. Other Ayurvedic type of ideas, acupuncture, moxibustion, things like that, burning sage and stuff, those don't have typically any drug interactions or anything. So again, coupling that with counseling and with the pharmacotherapy can absolutely be beneficial.
Absolutely. So I think sometimes I tend to think about these two things, naturopathic remedies and pharmacological remedies, in two different camps. But it sounds like what you're saying is this is a good idea to talk with your pharmacist before you start a naturopathic therapy.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there is sometimes a great divide between the Western idea with medicine and the Eastern medicine. And I know people that are on one side and I know people on the other. I like to be right in the middle because I think if it helps a person, it helps a person no matter what. Mm-hmm. So, and how to combine those can be a very potent remedy for a lot of different ailments.
So we'll shift again and maybe go to the how part of this. But how does a prescriber determine if a child needs a medication?
Absolutely. And this is where you're going to have a lot of trust in your provider and your doctor. There's a lot of different doctors out there, and depending on how they specialize and what they do, you want to get a good one that you feel is listening to you and to your children and making sure that what they say makes sense. And a pharmacist can also obviously help that and be a team member. But there, it's not something that you're going to be able to bring a child in on a regular basis to a physician and say, he's acting out or he has anger issues, you treat him. That's not the way that the world works anymore. We want to make sure what's going on and how, why is this manifesting, if it is at all. So using the child's voice is going to be really important in that one. And then we have a lot of different algorithms. So with an algorithm, it's kind of a diagnosis where we have the idea that maybe we think that a patient is depressed. So then we have a survey that they fill out, and it'll ask questions very similar to, have you been feeling depressed in the last week? Have you had thoughts about committing suicide or hurting yourself? Have you been giving away things that are really important to you? Do you stay up late thinking about things that are wrong? Things like this that are really trying to assess how is their mood. And then depending on the score that you would get, just like a test, if they score on a high enough level, then that's more indicative that, hey, there is an underlying problem. Now, sometimes it's the first visit, and one of the first things that's going to be prescribed is not a drug. It's going to be counseling. It's going to be sitting down, talking, maybe getting to the root of the cause. Is the child in foster care? Are they having a hard time transitioning? And having a counselor with that open voice and that they can say anything and not be judged for it is really, really beneficial because they feel like they have that platform and they can just vent, and sometimes that's all it takes. Now, if it gets bad enough, then combining the counseling with pharmacy and that drug is what that doctor will prescribe and look into. And again, there's a lot of different drugs out there to treat certain indications. If you search antidepressants, again, online, you're going to come up with 230,000 pages, all with different information.
It's overwhelming.
It is overwhelming, and it's really hard to find, especially now with our alternative facts out there, what can you trust and what can you not? When I have a patient come up and says, yes, I've been online doing research, inwardly I cringe because he's not looking at the same sites I am. I have paid subscriptions to different places so I can get the most up-to-date information that has studies backing up what I'm saying and how we're supporting things, versus things like a Medline or MedWatch program, or even Wikipedia, which a lot of people will say, yeah, I just Googled it and came up with random information. And the problem there is that sometimes there's good information, sometimes there's downright wrong information, worst times it's misleading information. So really trying to find what they know and be able to alter that is sometimes difficult. So I like patients that come up not necessarily doing a ton of research yet, and then having me be able to give them information and then other appropriate sites to find out some more information is actually beneficial to me. That way, there's not a stigma coming in already with our patients or the people that are going to be on these medications, the children and adolescents.
Yeah, and I think I just want to repeat that piece of advice that you said a minute ago, that you should find a pharmacist and or a doctor who listens to you and takes the feedback, because you know, we're living in a world now where it's not just the expert standing on top of the hill kind of telling you what to do, but listening to your life story and the context and things like that all factor into the type of treatment that's going to be.
Absolutely, and that is so important that we're a team and we're trying to transition more. I remember when I was a kid, the doctor was kind of a hierarchy. They were at the top of the pillar. And when the doctor spoke, you just listened, you nodded, and then you went your way. You may not have known what he was talking about, but you didn't want to either seem stupid or misinformed. And so you just kind of went on. Now we're trying to switch that whole role where it's a healthcare team. And the team is going to comprise of the family, the person that may have need that diagnosis with depression, anxiety, things like that. And it's also going to include your doctor. It's going to include your nurse. It's going to include your pharmacist. We all should be working together for the best of our patient. Mm-hmm. And that is so important, to find that team that you feel comfortable with and the people that are going to support you.
Okay, so now once you've determined that a child needs a medication and is going to use one, how do you determine a couple of other things, like how often they take it or how much of the medication they take? Or, as you said, you know, there's 100 different types of medications to treat just anxiety. I might be exaggerating, but how do you choose the type of medication, for example?
You know, the type of medication is going to depend on the severity of the diagnosis. So let's say on that test that you did for depression that you scored a 50%. So maybe you're in between, it might be light. They're going to start maybe on a whole different regimen versus somebody that might be the 90 percentile, where they're like, okay, this is pretty bad, this is severe. They may even be suicidal. We're going to treat those different because they're different people and they're in different stages. But as a rule of thumb for a lot of the mental health disorders out there, what we're looking at is called start low and go slow. What that means is that we're going to choose a drug based off of the patient profile, allergies, things that we think that might work. What we found out, if family members also have the same diagnosis, that the drugs used to treat them typically work for, if it works for a mom, that it would work for a daughter or a son. So we like to include, again, more of the holistic approach, finding out what is everything going on, and then starting on those medications. At that point, we start low, meaning a really low dose first. Remember that we're altering brain chemistry here. These are the psychotropic medications. If you go too fast, they're going to have a lot of different side effects. They're going to have at least a very bad headache, nausea, vomiting, mood swings. So we want to make sure that the transition goes well and that they can tolerate the medication. So we're going to choose a low dose. Start out, and you'll find that you may even take a half of a tablet for a week, maybe even a couple of weeks, and then increase based off of the side effects of the medication. It's important to know that when we start a medication, it's not something that we want to say, here you go, let us know how it goes. We want follow-up appointments. I, as a pharmacist, like to see my patients back to get that refill. It's always something that I ask. How is everything going? Are you feeling better? Has the doctor contacted you? Do you have another appointment? Because this it shouldn't be one that you have the diagnosis and then you're cut free and you're saying, there you go. This should be something that somebody's following along with the progress to make sure that it is working. And that way, if it is working, we can increase the dose. Maybe if we just want a little bit more, or if it's not working or not enough, or there's different side effects involved that we don't necessarily want, then that can help us switch it to a different medication that might work better.
Yeah, and you know, physically, if you break a leg, you're going to go get a cast, but that's not the last appointment.
That's
right?
not the exactly.
You go
that's,
in and
that's
you get
the first
on
of
and,
many.
Right.
Until
and mental health is the same.
Mental health is exactly the same. It's just that you don't see the fracture on an X-ray. There's
right.
not that diagnosis criteria, but we still want to follow up. We want to make sure that there is a healing process going on and that the patients are stable and they're doing well.
But also for physical issues as well. If you're taking 100%. A painkiller, you should be talking.
Absolutely.
Okay, so now that a child is, you know, they have a medication and they're taking it, when do you make a determination or how do you make a determination on when the child doesn't need that medication or can change doses or can stop altogether?
This, again, depends on the diagnosis and the severity of what's going on. Sometimes what happens is if we get situational depression or even seasonal depression. Mm-hmm. So when the fall is over, we get the nights more, there's not as much sun, we're a little bit more lethargic, people mm-hmm. get that seasonal affective disorder, and they can get a little bit more depression during that time. They can be started on those medications, and then when it gets sunny out, their mood swings up and they can be off those medications. Sometimes it's a death of a family member that might trigger a depressive episode. Sometimes it may be a foster child that's been in transition that does a lot to the brain. And it's just not about going from one place to the other. It's how are they feeling that? How are they doing emotionally on that? Mm-hmm. And sometimes that can take 3 months of a medication to make them feel better. Sometimes it's years. Sometimes it's lifelong. Prime example of this guy is your ADHD medications out there. When you get the diagnosis of ADHD, it's a lifetime diagnosis. It's not something that you ever outgrow. Mm-hmm. What people find out when they're off the medications is that they may do fine without those medications. A lot of times they'll do better with them. But what happens is that they're managing around what's going on in their bodies and their focus. So being out of school, they're out of high school or right into the college or having a job, they're typically doing the same thing. They have a little bit more time and they can kind of get a routine. Having a routine is a really great thing. Sometimes you can step off those medications and still maintain that routine. Other times it doesn't work, but that diagnosis is lifelong. It doesn't go away. Depression can wane mm-hmm. and can go away, and then it can come back. We find that people who have had a depressive episode are more prone to getting it later in life as well. So again, it's not something that has a great answer for this is when you stop, this is when you go. Absolutely 100% depends on the person. If they've been stable for quite some time and they want to try to step down off those medications, it's important not to stop them cold turkey. We get a lot of patients come in and say, I don't want to be on these anymore, and I just stop them. I guarantee in 3 to 5 days, they're going to come in saying, what just happened to me? Since we're affecting brain chemistry, that is a process. And when you start those medications, once again, hitting that go low and slow, it takes anywhere from a month to a month and a half of these medications to get their full effect. With a lot of the medications, really 1 to 2 weeks, you'll start feeling the effects of those medications, but for the full effect is a month and a half out. So you can imagine where if it takes a whole month and a half to get where you need to go in that body, if you stop it all of a sudden, you're not going to feel good. And as a healthcare provider, I think it's more than fine. If a patient is stable and wants to stop their medication, I think that's a great choice and that we can help with that transition. And talking to the doctor and the pharmacist, and then what we're going to do is get you off of that medication slowly. So having you take a half a tablet for a while, maybe even going every other day on a medication. But it should always, always be included in a doctor visit, and that the pharmacist is involved in that too. So yeah. We can closely monitor that. If symptoms do come back, then we can get back up there.
And so you might have a plan at the beginning of how long this treatment of drugs will last, but just like with any complicated system, like the brain is, it's a process and it's a conversation and things can change.
It is, and kind of going back to the example with a broken leg, mm-hmm. we know exactly how long that should heal typically. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's routine. Other people might take a little bit longer, mm-hmm. and some people might do it a lot quicker and be able to put weight on that. The brain is similar, but it's different because it is so complex. There's so much going on there that when that brain balances out finally, it's sometimes hard to get off of those medications and feel kind of the quote normal. So it is difficult, but definitely if that is a want to get off those medications, then it should just be focused that sometimes it may be best to be on those medications and we can try to get you off of them. But if those symptoms come back, we want you to be healthy. We want you to be happy. We want you to be a productive member of society. And being depressed and feeling bad isn't helping you, your family, or society. So we want to make sure that those choices are made with the patient in mind to make sure that we can help them on that path.
So if I could ask kind of more of a specific question about children with brain-based disabilities, mm-hmm. say learning disabilities or developmental disorders, what kind of prescription drugs and psychotropic medications are used and prescribed in those situations? And to treat what? What are you using those
right.
for?
What we're using those for a lot is more of the balancing act again. Mm-hmm. And with brain disorders, whether it be functional, where they had a trauma that happened to them, or whether it be more of a kind of an internal basis, this is the way they were born, they're mm-hmm. just behind, is difficult to say what medications are going to work the best and not on. So on that level, what we're trying to do is just balance the brain and make sure that how it's communicating to one another, again, going back to the inside out, is one of your characters speaking French and the other English? What is the proper way to make that communication work? And that's just an easy one. Now imagine in a brain case that all the different characters are speaking a different language, and there's only three books to translate that. It can get very, very complex very, very easily. So what we're going to try to use with those medications is things that may help balance that out. Maybe instead of offering five different languages, we can get it down to three. And that in itself helps out those people in that area because the body's able to relax just a little bit more and really be able to process a little bit better. The important thing is to go at their pace and not what you think their pace should be. If people are behind, it's not the end of the world by any stretch of imagination. I always hate the idea of the word retarded because when I was in high school and in college, I babysat a Down syndrome kid named Alex. He was amazing. He was great. And he went at his own pace. And I think that was so important lesson for me to learn to say, you know, not everybody is going to be vanilla cookie cutter. And I think seeing that firsthand and knowing the joy that there's in it is a good thing. Enjoy the path that they're on. Medications can help, but again, focusing on motor skills, fine motor skills, with physical therapist, counseling for not only the person but the family is really, really important.
So another question that I have is how these drugs are developed. Are they developed with children in mind, or are some of them developed for adults and then used in children? You know, what are the complexities around that that people should be aware of?
There are a lot of complexities with treating children and mm-hmm. developing drugs specifically for children. When a drug is being developed, we first come out with this brand new structure of a medication that we're going to name some weird name based off of its structure, and then we do a lot of in vitro testing. So it's more test tubes at the very beginning to find out, does this work, does this not? And then they are going to go to maybe some animal studies and say, okay, did this work? It's not for folks on depression. We don't know if a rat is depressed. We don't know, but we can see how it affects the brain chemistry. Is it making the brain talk better? Is it calming the brain down? Things like that that we can see. So that goes through a rigorous process. You're talking years and years and years of this testing to see what works. If there is good outcomes on that one, then we're going to open it up and say, okay, this should be working in humans. And with that, we need to get humans to take this medication, knowing that we don't know necessarily the side effects, if it's going to work. We don't know if it's going to cause any harm. So there's a lot of waivers that go through the process of getting that drug to the market, and that's one of the big hurdles, because I know I have three boys of my own, and I would never ever sign an investigational new drug to say, hey, will you try this out? And they try it in healthy individuals first. It's not the people that have this diagnosis or disease. It's healthy individuals to see how they respond to it. I, as a parent, would absolutely say no, as most parents would, knowing that maybe it's going to work, maybe it doesn't, but I don't necessarily want to be that guinea pig. Mm-hmm. But adults typically are better at making those decisions, and there's sometimes reimbursement for them. So you'll hear about the poor med student trying to work through a school where he's like, I'm going to try this new drug and get reimbursement for it. So at that point, then we're trying it out on an adult patient to see how this response, how's it working. At that point, then we typically open it up to, if that goes well and there's no bad adverse effects or things are going well, then we open it up to a population specific with that diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Again, there's waivers involved. We don't typically focus on the pediatric or the adolescents. It's purely because it's still investigational. So it gets very, very difficult. So we, after years and maybe even a decade has passed, this new drug is finally brought to the market. And at that point, we sometimes will do dosing with pediatrics and children, but it's more anecdotal and it's more low doses to see how does this work. And then those, after it's brought to the market, there's more and more studies done to say, all right, so as a pharmacist, if a patient comes up to me with an adverse effect or a side effect, I am looking into that, saying, well, I didn't know if that would happen or not. So I'm reporting this on to the drug site to make sure that they know, hey, this is happening. Maybe it was just that person, they were having a bad day, or they tripped and fell. Maybe people that are on this medication are tripping and falling all the time. Well, that's more indicative, maybe there's an issue with falling or drowsiness, dizziness, things like that. So we need to be forthcoming with that information. Right. But it is difficult. But the ones that are out there that have been studied in pediatrics that work, they're out there, and there's a lot of evidence to say they work really, really well.
And it's nice to know that these new drugs are tested years and years before they're even ever used in a human.
Correct, absolutely. And it's not just something somebody came up with in their basement and said, here, try this, it'll work. There's years and years of investigation, millions upon millions of dollars spent into this process before it ever hits the market.
And then before it's used in a child, there's usually quite a bit of consideration.
Quite a bit of consideration based off of the side effect profile. We want to make sure that we know that an adult person is different than a six-year-old
developmentally
person.
Different.
A,
yes.
Developmentally, and B, physically, their growing patterns, what's going on, hormones related. There's a lot more intricate involvement. They're not apples to apples, per se, even though the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Well, sometimes it does in that way. So they have to grow into that sapling of their own, and we don't want to make sure we don't hinder that process.
Oh, absolutely. I think I only have one more question for you. What are some of the prevailing attitudes around the use of psychotropic medications in Montana, and specifically for kids as well?
Absolutely. You
know, how is it different from a national type of... Because we talked about stigmas and things like that exist all over the country. Montana is maybe a little different.
Montana is a little different than, obviously, the East Coast would be in their views. We tend to have kind of the motto to buck it up. And that's not necessarily helpful. I know if you broke your leg and I told you, hey, buck it up, it hurts still. And there's a pain involved and there's a process involved. Unfortunately, with your mental health disorders, they are not apparent. There's not a test that would say, hey, you broke your leg. So some people think that they might be broken. There's that stigma to say, I just need to work through this and not talk about it because I just need to be a man, or I need to be that woman who is perfect and have that attitude. So there still is that attitude in Montana, unfortunately, that we don't need to be open and talk about our feelings. So it is difficult to get past that stigma, because asking for help and getting the help that you need can be so much better instead of going down a path that is so dark for so long. And then by the time you finally reach out for help, things are in a worse or critical condition than they would have been at the very beginning. So there is that stigma in Montana, absolutely. But it is getting better. I've seen more and more involvement with parents being open to the ideas that, hey, something's going on here. Let's work it out, talk about it, and then see what we can do to help with this situation. Mm-hmm. And again, that might just be counseling. it might have a drug involved in it. But to be open and honest and not to say that the person is broken. And that's another thing. If you break your leg, oh, they were clumsy. But if you're depressed or antisocial or if you are behind in your classwork for reasons, they tend to look at those people and say, well, they're behind, they're lazy, they're broken. And that's the worst thing we can do. Yeah. I think as a society, we need to lift each other up. So instead of giving handouts, give hand-ups and make sure that we're all on the same path, because really, ultimately, we are.
I like the handouts.
I try. I was like, hey.
Yeah, that's great.
I like that.
So I'm thinking, you know, about growing up and grandpa always saying, oh, you got to walk the fences, make sure that nothing's broken. And really, I think medication can be on the same track as Montana values of always working hard, making sure things are fixed before they get too broken. And
absolutely.
Yeah, I think you can sell it that way, and it makes a lot more sense to folks.
Absolutely package it that way. And having those Montana values, Montana values are strong with people. And doing it to make sure that if your house has a leak, we are up on the roof fixing it. Yeah. That's that Montana value. We're not going to call out a guy for $3,000 to come and say that we need a new roof. We're going to get up there and we're going to fix the problem ourselves. So if we can take that same mentality that we have with that mental health, and to say, hey, let's instead of doing a check with a leaky roof, let's do an internal check and say, how really am I feeling? Am I doing well? Then I think the world would be much better and Montana would be much stronger and absolutely the best last place.
I think so too. So what do you think people should know about working with kids who take psychotropic medications, or for, you know, teachers or parents or basically anybody that kids interact with who might think, I think that this student or child that I work with could really benefit from this sort of thing? And you know, what do you want people to know who are in that situation?
What I want people to know in that situation, I think above all, is that they're still a person, first and foremost, and to lose that connection with them because they're acting out or because they get aggressive or because they're just really sad or sullen loses that bit of who they are. So treat them as a person first and then work with them. And it has to be with them to come to a commonality to say, hey, there is a problem. How should we best fix this? And I think treat them as that one person first and foremost, and not a disease. When you have a patient with diabetes, I don't say, hello, diabetic, how are you? We want to use their names. We don't want to profile people and make them feel worse than what they already feel. That's going to build walls. And with the more walls they have, the harder it is to get through and to get them the help that they need. And knowing that these medications aren't the cure is really, really important. With an antibiotic, if you have an infection, we give this to you, you feel better. It depends on how that antibiotic works. Some of them will absolutely kill that bacteria. Some of them just kind of calm it down a little bit so that you and your body can kill it. So those work a lot differently than your psychotropic medications. The psychotropic medications are there, but the underlying current doesn't necessarily go away. There's not a trigger in there that's wrong or broken. It just is a balancing act. And thinking about it that way is important, because if you have a drug and you treat that patient as just the drug, then you're going to only fixate on that one small piece of who they are. A drug doesn't cure all the time. It sometimes helps you get balanced and where you need to be, and knowing that there's other things besides that drug that are really, really important for their well-being. The counseling, the talking, being open and being able to communicate with people is extremely important.
So psychotropic medications is a big subject and one that is really hard to break into. So I hope that this conversation has been one to help you understand the subject, whether you know very little about psychotropic medications or you're a longtime expert on the field. Ideally, you'll have an appreciation of the subject that helps break down some of the veil of mystery and the stigmas that come along with psychotropic medications, or just be able to better explain them to someone. As always, if you have questions or you want to contact us with new ideas, just send us an email at ccfwd@mso.umt.edu. Our website is your one-stop shop to find more episodes and so many other resources to help you in your work with young people. So be sure to check it out. Just go to health.umt.edu/ccfwd. That's health.umt.edu/ccfwd. Thanks again to Ira Wolf for our music, and thanks a lot to Ken for being a great guest. I hope you all enjoyed this episode and that you'll join us next time for the Center for Children, Families, and Workforce Development podcast. I'm Zach Reamer. Take care of yourself this week, and I'll see you next time.